okay if we could have people take their seats and extinguish the conversations here, we'll get started. Representative Gottwalt, House File 1945, until we get a quorum, we'll just not take any formal action, just start to present your bill in any way you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 1945 has been a long time in coming. We've had a broad-based coalition of people ranging from prosecutors.
Just a second, Representative Gottwalt.
Yes.
People in the back of the room, if you could please stop talking, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With House File 1945, we are creating a new felony neglect, felony deprivation statute that is really long overdue. We've been working with a broad-based coalition of people ranging from prosecutors to the long-term care community, hospitals, and others to make sure that we got the language right so that we don't create unintended consequences and yet still get tough on people who willfully neglect vulnerable adults to the point of great bodily harm. And so I'm very pleased to bring this bill forward. I'm going to ask my testifiers to say their piece. We won't take a lot of time on the bill, Mr. Chair, but if members have questions. One thing I would like to do, if I could, before we move along, there are a couple of amendments that were made on the Senate side that are really grammatical in nature that I'd like to put in here on the House side so that we can keep the bill moving in the same form. So I believe somebody on your committee is going to need to make this motion, if I'm not mistaken, correct? Let me state the change first, and then you can make the
motion. We'll have to, before we can vote on a more moving, we've got to have a quorum and take the roll and all that. So
okay.
We're not quite there yet, I think.
Well, maybe what I could do, Mr. Chair, is describe the changes, and then we could wait to make a motion on them. Would that be okay?
Well, we should have enough time.
Okay, the first change is on line 1.16.
Okay, here we go.
There we go. We have a.
There we go.
All right.
We'll bring the meeting to order. The Public Safety, Crime Prevention, Policy, and Finance. Mr. Sparby, would you take the roll?
Chairman Cornish?
Here.
Vice Chairman Woodard?
Here.
Representative Mullery? Representative Doubt?
Here.
Representative Gauthier?
Here.
Representative Grunhagen? Representative Hilty? Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Kiefer?
Here.
Representative Kreisel?
Here.
Representative Leidiger? Representative Mariani? Representative McDonald? Representative Moran?
Here.
Representative Nornes? Representative Slocum? Representative Smith?
Here.
Okay. And we have a quorum, and if somebody would move the minutes of February 21st.
So moved.
Representative Kreisel moves the minutes of February 21st. Any comments, conditions, or corrections? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion minutes approved. The chair will move House File 1945. Representative Gottwalt's bill be recommended to pass and move to Ways and Means. We're going to catch up to it with a an updated fiscal note, I believe, and then you have a couple of amendments. I probably have to get the folks' approval if you explain the amendments, since we are the 24-hour deadline. If you want to make oral amendments, and if get the okay from if that's okay with those folks, because I want to ask, what are you up with that? Okay, Representative Gottwalt, if you want to move the amendments.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair and committee. These, again, are grammatical changes that were made on the Senate side. They're non-substantial, and all the parties to the bill negotiation agree with the changes so far. So on line 1.16 of the bill, we are inserting a comma between the words provisions and is. And on line 2.32 of the bill, we are deleting the words due to and inserting the words because of. The Senate has an English teacher on its committee, and so
is that the only ones?
So if somebody would be willing to move those changes?
Yeah. Representative Gauthier?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be willing to move that oral amendment for Representative Gottwalt.
Okay, staff, you have the oral amendment down then? Okay. Yeah, thank you. All right. Representative Guthrie moves the amendments on line 1.16 with the comma and line 2.32, strike due to and put in because of. And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion carried. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With this, I think I'll turn it over to our testifiers, and then we'll open it up for questions.
If you state your name and title and begin, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I am David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. Before I turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Sweezy, I simply want to let you know that the goal of the bill was to target the kinds of deprivation against our most vulnerable adults that result in the absolute worst harm, the great bodily harm and substantial bodily harm. And after the bill was initially introduced, we heard concerns from a number of different groups. Care providers were concerned that it might adversely impact their facilities and Medicare. A number of the unions representing the line workers at facilities were concerned that it would adversely impact their members where they were understaffed or had inadequate supervision. And people were generally concerned that the felony crime of deprivation would not be, was too easy, frankly, to prove. They wanted more, they wanted to tighten up that language. With Representative Gottwald's leadership, we all sat down in a room and really worked hard to come together with the language that you have seen. Representatives from the care providers, the unions, the advocates for vulnerable adults, family members, all of those groups together with the prosecutors got together and put together the proposal you have in front of you. And I simply, I know those groups, because of time, aren't all going to come up and say that. You have a packet of letters in your packets that represent an incredible amount of hard work on everybody's side. And I simply wanted to point that out and to thank all of them for the enormous amount of work, and frankly, to Representative Gottwald for forcing us all to the table. Because while I think everybody gets something in this, that's interested in this bill, and frankly, everybody gave something to make this happen. And it is rare sometimes in this building that we are able to make that work. And I wanted to acknowledge those people and acknowledge the hard work that went into it. With that, I will turn it over to my colleague to walk through the bill.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. If you would state your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Amy Sweezy, S-W-E-A-S-Y. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney in the Adult Prosecution Division, and I am the supervisor of our Vulnerable Adult Prosecution team in Hennepin County. And the reason we're here and the reason we've asked for the change in the law is that the penalty right now for neglecting a vulnerable adult is a gross misdemeanor, regardless of what happens. There was an absence of a felony provision for that. What we found when we reviewed cases, when we reviewed outcomes to persons as well as outcomes to criminal defendants, we found that it simply was too broad a range of conduct and harm that was occurring to be lumped into one category of a gross misdemeanor. So it is that need for the felony legislation that brought us here. What we've done is to create an entirely separate crime from the gross misdemeanor, and it would involve the intentional deprivation by a caregiver of food, clothing, shelter, supervision, or health care. There are two different theories under which charges could be brought under the crime of deprivation. The first is that the caregiver or the operator would have to know or have reason to know that the harm could result from the conduct. So there is an intentional element plus a requirement of knowledge. The other theory under which the charges could be brought would be that the conduct occurred and the intentional deprivation occurred over an extended period of time. That borrows a concept from the child abuse statutes, the extended period of time notion, to gather the cases literally where people are locked away in rooms or basements or wherever for days, weeks, months, those types of crimes. There are exemptions written into the gross misdemeanor statute now that would be part of this that we did not touch. That is meant to cover the actions of caregivers that come from medical directives, reasonable administration of medical care, and prior pre-existing consensual adult relationships. The penalty sections borrow the concepts of substantial bodily harm and great bodily harm, well worn in the criminal code in Minnesota, most notably from the assault statutes, and break out the degrees of bodily harm based on those. 5-year felony, that would be the maximum for substantial bodily harm, and 10 years for the more severe great bodily harm. The part of the work that we did that Mr. Brown was speaking about has to do with the creation of the affirmative defenses at the end of the statute. What we did there was literally carve out the three types of fact scenarios that were of concerns to different groups to make sure that certain conduct does not result in a criminal conviction. The first is to provide the what we call the line worker in a facility or group home the protection from criminal prosecution or conviction that would result if they were unable to do the provide the care that they needed to because of inadequate staffing, inadequate supervision, or inadequate institutional policies where they work, if they're simply unable to provide that and can show that. The second is the reverse. It is the protection for the operator or the facility itself, otherwise well-purposed and running everything the way they should, to protect them from the lone actor who simply decides on his or her own to engage in this kind of conduct, provided that the facility could not have known about that. The final affirmative defense provides for someone to come forward and say, I wasn't able to provide the care that I needed to this person because I was caring for somebody else. We had a lot of talks about that in our efforts to get everybody on the same page. And the scenario basically is two call lights at once. What is a care provider to do, particularly in a facility, but we could imagine it happening elsewhere, where two people need the help of that caregiver at the same time? And obviously no one can be two places at the same time, and the point of that affirmative defense is to say, I made the decision that I needed to make at the time that was reasonable and necessary for me to do so, and unfortunately the other harm befell the other person. We don't intend for that to be something that people should be prosecuted for. So those are the three affirmative defenses that were really the product of the work that we did, in addition to tightening up the elements in the first place to prove the intentional deprivation.
Okay, Mr. Chair, with that, I think we'll take questions.
Okay, Representative Gottwald. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier on affirmative defenses, assuming that they couldn't provide adequate supervision because of call lights, is the facility then vulnerable to prosecution if they have a history of shortage of staffing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that could be. The thing about the affirmative defenses is that they are very, very much evidence dependent. So It's hard to hypothesize. But I can imagine a scenario where a care provider or someone falling into that two call lights category could say, not only was I reasonably and necessarily providing care to another person, but the reason there was only me was because there was inadequate staffing or something. You certainly could have some overlap in these areas, but then we might really be looking at a different affirmative defense. This, the third one, really is meant to assume everything else is working fine at the facility. There aren't problems with supervision or training. There aren't problems with the qualifications or the intentions of the employee, but it simply is just the way that it happened. So that's the thinking that went into it. But certainly other things can be implicated in those situations.
Representative Guthrie.
I understand that. I guess what I'm saying is I could visualize an employee coming to the county saying, this is a repeated pattern that happens at my facility, and we've gone to management. They haven't done anything about it. So I understand that they would be free from prosecution, but would that open an investigation on the facility?
Good, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it certainly could, absolutely. If there was that kind of evidence that was coming forward, that any time the police's work takes us in a different direction, obviously that would be something we would explore.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Mr. Brown, go ahead.
Thank you. And Representative Gottlieb, these were part of the exact discussions we had with the operators and obviously the representatives on the line workers, and I point you back to the fallback that ultimately the state has to prove that the deprivation was intentional. So if you were going to try to prove that against an operator, you'd have to show that they intentionally deprived that vulnerable adult of it. So I think that was all part of that discussion.
Hey, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Didn't realize I'd get up that quick. Either Mr. Brown or Ms. Swayze?
Either.
Okay. I understand what you're talking about and need to get at in general. However, this one seems to be broad enough to get at a situation that I saw Bill around here before a few years ago, which I thought was terrible. And in talking, I used to do elder law, so I know the people involved, and I know a lot of doctors that work with them, and they were all very opposed to that bill. And the situation is, here was the situation that why the bill came. There was an old couple in their 80s, and they were, I think it was the one of them anyhow fell, and in the basement. And couldn't get up or something like that. And the other person was taken by the situation and went down and just sat with their spouse for days. And, of course, the spouse who had been injured, that harmed the spouse greatly. It seems to me that technically fits in where you could prosecute that spouse that didn't do what would be appropriate in that situation from somebody like us. And that was just, according to every elder law attorney, doctors, everything, were extremely opposed to prosecuting or even putting in a law that might result in that, because there is nothing, if you really get into elderly care, there is nothing as important. You can have the greatest physical care in the world, but the mental relationship between people, especially when they're starting Alzheimer's or anything like that, even more and later, is far more important than the physical care. And it looks to me like they would not qualify for number three here because it's too I don't know if you say loose or broad, but I'm very worried about that situation because we had a bill that was tried to be forced through here on that.
Mr. Baum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery. Well, this is not that bill. I think there is a different bill that you're thinking about, and I think before you came in, I had pointed out to the rest of the committee that what you have in your packet are letters from the hospital associations and the representatives of the vulnerable adults, the AARP. There are just a number of different groups. What we did was all get together to make sure we did not have that on this bill. We have the people representing all of those providers, the people providing line care, the people running the facilities, to make sure that was not included. That your concerns, the kinds of things you're describing, would not be here, and particularly in the situation you describe, we've added an element that's never been there before. It's in the child neglect statute, I believe, that requires that the just to prove the initial crime, the caregiver must have been reasonably able to provide those things. And obviously in a case where the other person in the home has beginning dementia, has some other weaknesses, that would not be the case. Nobody was intending to criminalize those kinds of actions. We've also added two elements that have never been there before, with having to know reason to know that the deprivation could likely result in the kinds of harm that we're talking about, or that it occurred over an extended period of time. So we've taken care of a lot of the concerns that were raised in some of those prior bills, and I will tell you, based on our work with those provider groups over an extended period of time, they have not raised those concerns with this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Brown, I'll try to talk to you about the language maybe a little after this before it goes further or something like
sure.
that. Because if you're really not trying to get at it, I think it's a little too loose right now, but I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, if I could add to that briefly, I just consulted with Ms. Swayze as well. Representative Mullery, I know what you're talking about. That is not a situation they would prosecute under this law. That's what we've been told. The situation you described there is a safe harbor for that, and that's exactly what we spent a lot of time and a lot of effort trying to negotiate into the language of this bill, is to create the layering, you know, the intent as well as the language in these bills combined. You would not have a situation where the person in this situation you described would ever be charged.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Gottwald. I'll just talk to about the language, make sure.
Anybody else to testify in support or opposition to this bill? Representative Gottwald, if you'd like to make any closing remarks.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, of the author. Representative Gottwald, we have here in our material a consolidated fiscal note, and I'll reference a couple portions of it. It says that the estimated bed impact, I'm old-fashioned, I'd call it need for prison cells, but that's not appropriate language, so I won't say that. But it does say that there will be a bed impact, a need for additional prison beds, thus costing additional spending in our corrections portion of our budgets. It also references that it presents, and I'm reading this, it does present the already overburdened criminal justice and public defender systems with additional cases and time commitments. Anytime there is an increase in penalties or expansion of criminal law, the result will be more cases, more contested cases, and more appeals. So, Representative Gottwald, I just want to be clear. You are carrying a bill here that's going to raise spending and add additional cases to the public defender system, which will also, they will also be back and ask for more money. Isn't that correct?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, you will also note in that fiscal note in front of you that the amount is about $10,000 for a year, and I'm not saying that's inconsequential, but what we've been told by the department is that that would not result in any additional appropriation. It is not that great of an impact on the system that it would require additional appropriation. We certainly think for the increased safety to vulnerable adults and the ability to actually provide a felony level prosecution for the kind of atrocious abuse and neglect of vulnerable adults that we've heard and seen on some of the news articles and investigations over the last few years, that is certainly a worthy bit of expenditure. But again, we did check with the department. They indicated, and we're hoping to get a letter from them at some point to verify it for the purpose of committee members, that no additional appropriation would be necessary. Again, members, if you look at that fiscal note, came over from the Senate side, it's germane to the language that's in the bill. $10,000 for a year.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Well, Representative Gottwald, just to be precise for the record we're creating here, it says the estimated cost will increase to $49,000 in fiscal year 16. Admittedly, a drop in the bucket in compared to our budget, but to be precise, it isn't just 10. According to this, it will rise to $49,000 in fiscal year 16.
Representative Smith, you're correct, and I that's one of the reasons we're not sending it to the consent calendar. We're putting it to the Ways and Means and hopefully catch up with an updated fiscal note. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative
okay.
Powell.
Anybody else in questions, support, oppositions? If not, Representative Gottwalt, you have any closing statements? I'll just move House File 1945. We recommend it to pass and move as amended, move to Ways and Means. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Gottwalt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Representative Kriesel, do you want to do 2302 next? The
are we?
Predatory offenders.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Representative Kriesel, you go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2302 to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Kriesel moved his bill 2302. Do you have any amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There is the A1 amendment would correct some dates in the bill. And I'd like to move that amendment.
Okay. Okay. Representative Kriesel moves his A1 amendment to get it in the form that the author would like it. Without objection, all in favor say aye.
Oh, sure.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Are we on
the? You can present your bill, Representative Kriesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, there's a couple other issues that I'd like to tighten up before it goes to Judiciary. This is this bill comes from an issue that happened in my district in Newport. There was a motel owner who was a registered sex offender. He was convicted in 2000 of attempting to rape a 10-year-old female relative. He spent more than 6 years in prison for the crime. The story should be in your green binder. The issue comes from the fact that he was able to be an owner of the motel and have access to the rooms. And he made his way into one of the guest rooms and was conducting inappropriate relations with a young girl while her mother was sleeping. So the city of Newport contacted myself and Senator Sieben to see if we can change this and prevent it from happening in anybody else's community. So that's where this bill, House File 2302, comes from. I've been in contact with the hotels and motels, and some of them will testify today. My intent is to continue to work with them to find a solution to take care of this. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I am open to questions, or we can have testifiers come up, and I could do questions after.
Okay, Representative Kriesel, do you have anybody to testify in support?
No, not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and Representative Johnson, and then we'll start the questioning. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kriesel, will there be is there a fiscal note forthcoming on this?
I do not think there was one needed. If there's one needed, I can request one.
Okay, yeah, I think it seemed like it makes sense to request one.
Okay.
Representative Kriesel, was there a question?
No, I just wanted to ensure that we have some discussion.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We could request one, that's fine.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anybody else? Mr. McElroy.
And while he's coming up, I guess I did a poor job of actually explaining exactly what the bill would do. It would require background checks for anybody, any employees that have access to the guest rooms. So that's the intent of the bill. And if you want to testify now.
I do. This is what I'm talking.
Okay.
While they're passing them out, why don't you go ahead and give your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Lodging Association.
You could bring one of those up to the chair first, one of them. See what it is.
And the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. I want to thank Representative Kriesel for bringing this bill. We share his great concern about this incident. And there was a second, less serious incident in the city of St. Paul on December 28th when a desk clerk who had a previous conviction in a related area but not at the level that would have required registration committed a crime related to the privacy of a guest. And so both of our associations have taken the position that we support background checks. The safety of our guests is of paramount importance. I appreciate Representative Kreisel's willingness to work with us on the details, essentially. I particularly want to applaud him for including Section 6 of the bill. We are very supportive of the idea of placing a portion of the burden on the person who would apply for or continue to serve in a job and not just on the lodging property. And so we think that is an ideal approach. We have a few concerns that I'll bring to your attention. Representative Kreisel is aware of them, and we'll work with them to find solutions. There are about between 1,400 and 1,500 lodging properties in Minnesota, about 900 hotels and motels, somewhere between 100 and 200 bed and breakfast inns. That number moves around some, and about 500 resorts. About 90% of the resorts are managed by resident owner-operators, by they sometimes referred to mom and pop. I prefer to call them family businesses in Minnesota. We'll need to deal with the issue of how an owner-operator who gets the background check. The current bill may not have a fiscal impact because it doesn't connect this to licensing, and all lodging properties are licensed. The Department of Health has expressed a concern as to their responsibilities in licensing, so we'll need to resolve and work that out. Whether very, very small property that has no non-family employees should have an exemption, I think we should talk about that. Our smallest lodging members have 4 rooms, and our smallest resort member has 5 rooms. Our smallest bed and breakfast has 2 rooms and has no non-family employees. And so that'd be an issue that we'll be discussing. We prefer the definition unsupervised access to rooms, but we understand that that will be a challenging definition to work on. Currently, the bill requires, or the law requires, that this is amending, that someone who has lived in the state for less than 10 years would do a federal background check, which includes fingerprints. Some of our larger members have a large number of housekeepers who have access, but it's not unsupervised. Their keys, their most brands now are moving toward room access key or systems that you're familiar with that have a magnetic stripe or some of them an RFID card. A housekeeper has access only to the rooms to which he or she is assigned and only during their shift, and there's a record of which rooms they entered. And so their access is tightly supervised. Desk clerks are not. Some mechanics, housemen, janitors are not. Certainly night auditors. The management staff should have full federal background checks. We would argue and would hope to make the point that those with fully supervised access should not be subject to what for many of them would be a great cultural shock. They may come from countries where having one's fingerprints taken is a frightening experience, and it's a balancing act that we'd like to have that discussion. There will need to be, we've suggested to Representative Kreisel that in Section 6, ownership should be added, so that a registered sex offender at the levels that his final bill will provide would not own, manage, or operate, because owners kind of by de facto, by their status as owners, have access. There'll need to be some language that allows an owner time to divest that ownership in the event they qualify for this circumstance. The current bill is of some concern to cities, counties, and the Department of Health that have to license a property, because it implies that somebody's going to check but doesn't say who. And so who's going to do the checking will need to be addressed. But those are our general concerns. We are very supportive of the concept, and we'll work with Representative Kreisel on the details. And I'm pleased to hear that it's going to Judiciary, so we'll have a little time to work on this. But, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to express these opinions on behalf of about 900 of our members, and I'd be happy to take questions if there are any.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McElroy. Representative Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. McElroy. Just wondering why the small motel operators should be treated any differently, and I'm wondering also if this Newport Motel was a small one.
Mr. McElroy.
The Shorelock Motel had 20 units, some of which functioned more like apartments. And I would, and a bed and breakfast may be the ideal issue, where the owners live on site and rarely have non-family employees. And the issue, if we resolve the issue of where an owner or operator's background check goes, who's supposed to look at it, then the issue of exempting very small properties may not be an issue. But it is cumbersome to be responsible for a self-background check, particularly when the levels in the statute are fairly complex. I'm not expert on the CrimSec laws, but I understand it isn't even by section that crimes differ, it's by paragraph. And so to make, it will take, we need to have some further discussion about how those decisions are made. But the our interest in very small properties would be largely those with non-family employees.
Okay, Representative Mullery and then Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, and I guess Representative Kreisel, you'll have to answer this because I don't see anybody up there that's an attorney. It appears, I guess, to me, and I don't understand exactly what's happening, but the background check would include criminal vehicular homicide and injury, theft, burglary, and then would they be excluded as being an employee? I see number six just applies to operate or manage, and that picks up even, and I don't know what prostitution under the number, there's specific numbers in there. I'm not sure what kind of prostitution that is. Is it true that, for instance, a person couldn't be hired then as an employee if they've been convicted of the criminal vehicular homicide, theft, burglary, or then couldn't operate or manage if they've ever been convicted of prostitution?
As far as the criminal vehicle, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr.
Representative Mullery, as far as the criminal vehicular homicide, I'm quite sure that that's not the case, that they'd be prohibited. That's not my intent, and it's my understanding we're going to lay over this bill and clean up the language in there. I would like to remove prostitution from there because I don't think of that as a predatory offense, and my whole goal of this bill is to ensure the safety of the people staying in these hotels, motels. That's my entire goal. And so prostitution isn't as much of a concern. Criminal vehicular homicide, while that's a very serious offense, it doesn't mean that that person has a higher likelihood of going into a room to commit a sex crime.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kreisel, I hope you'll work with... I see the problems of youth especially getting involved in something... And we've got huge unemployment in some communities now because youth have committed some kind of a crime that would fall within, especially theft and burglary. And this would exclude them then from life from a whole big level of employment. And we just keep the legislators out of control, just knocking people out for life from jobs. And it's starting to affect our unemployment and our cost, more tax money has to go into when people can't have jobs. And so I hope you'll work with kind of narrowing this down to what's really needed, not such broad things like that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Christian.
Absolutely. That's what I intend on doing, and I'll continue to work on it. We'll bring it back when it's ready.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd like to ask Mr. McElroy a question if he'd return to the table. And
to restate your name and title. And
for the record, Dan McElroy, Minnesota Lodging Association, Minnesota Resort and Campground Association.
Reverend Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. McElroy, I'm looking at a one-page summary that we've all been given. On letterhead at the top is Minnesota Lodging Association and Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. Halfway down it says Explore Minnesota Tourism estimates that there are about 1,400 lodging properties of all types in the state. The Newport incident that we're discussing here today, it says here, is the only occurrence of its kind on record.
Since we typed, since we wrote that in December, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, there has been a second incident since that policy brief was adopted by my board. That was the one on December 28th in the city of St. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McElroy, was that one on the 28th the same level as the one we have here, or was it a lesser?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, it was at a lesser level. I don't know the crime for which this person has been charged, but it was an invasion of privacy kind of thing. This desk clerk inserted a video camera under the door of the room for the purpose at which he was successful of taping very private behavior. Fortunately, he was apprehended before he could put it on the internet.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McElroy, so then arguably there was has only been one incident of this kind that we're talking about here on record.
Mr. Chairman.
And if that's the case, is it your opinion that we need a bill that addresses one incident on record in the fashion of potentially giving background checks to hundreds of folks?
Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that's part of the reason why we're concerned about perhaps limiting this to people who have unsupervised access to keys. But when my members heard about this incident, they kind of their uniform reaction was, we're going to start doing background checks. Some of them do now. Most of the branded lodging properties that have a national brand like Best Western or Hilton or Americann already do some level of background check. Others are have an interest. This was serious enough that, and the burden is low enough, that if, particularly if we can agree to something that limits the number of people who have to have national background checks, it's good practice. Now, the question is, should it be in law, or is there a way to have it be uniform without that happening as a license condition, for example? We'd be willing to discuss other options.
Mr. Chairman, one last question.
Reverend Smith.
Mr. McElroy, so you would propose limiting it to people with unsupervised access to keys. How many people is that class? How many people are in that class?
Mr. Chairman, McElroy. Representative Smith, in small properties, it is probably one. In a large property, our largest member has 890 rooms, and it would be denominated in the dozens. It's room clerks, people in the management team.
Mr. Chairman, you didn't understand my question.
I know.
How many people statewide will be affected if you get it limited to what you want, unsupervised access to keys?
Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, in a very kind of rough estimate, it would be in the low thousands.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Representative Johnson is next, but keep in mind we've got some things to work out in language. We're going to lay the bill over, but do you want to ask a question before we do that?
Yeah, just because you might want to consider it as well, and that has to do with the issue of liability. Now, the city or municipality is the licensing agency, and if, let's say, a hotel, for example, in a Newport, didn't do the background check, something happened, to what extent would the municipality or city be liable for damages or a lawsuit?
Representative Creasel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm not sure.
So I guess as the matter gets laid over, that might be something to clear up.
Okay, and Representative Leiterker.
Thank you, and I'll be brief. And it's really a follow-up to Representative Smith's question, because we were trying to get an understanding of the numbers here, but what is the turnover rate in your industry, please? You know, because we're not just looking at the thousands that are currently employed, but I think your industry has a big turnover rate. Can you kind of talk to that a little bit?
Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I don't have a numeric turnover rate, but I agree with your observation that it is significant. In the resort side of the industry, for larger resorts, it's 30 to 35% a year at least because of the seasonal nature of their business. Our hotels vary greatly, but they have significant turnover. They are hiring very frequently, and so this would become part of their hiring process. If it is a state check, it's fairly automated. It's not very expensive. If it requires a national check, it requires a proper provision of fingerprints, usually involving a law enforcement agency. The fee is higher. We're not, I don't want to argue that the fees are an issue, but turnover is part of our industry. And Mr. Chair, if I could, Representative Johnson raised the issue of cities and counties being responsible.
You could give him a short answer, you bet.
Yes. That's true where cities and counties have delegated authority. In about 60 counties, it's the Minnesota Department of Health responsibility. In larger counties and in much of the metropolitan area, it's been delegated to cities and counties.
Okay. Representative Creasel, I support your bill and its overall content, but I think we've got to do a little work on it, and I'd like to temporarily, with no objections, lay the bill over for consideration at some time and encourage the different groups. And Mr. Haas, would that be okay with you, or did you want to testify today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My hope was that I would be over. I haven't had a chance to meet with Representative Creasel. He knows my concerns, and I'd love to work with him.
Okay. Is that okay with everybody? That we'll temporarily lay the bill over. Mr. Creasel, or Representative Creasel, excuse me, your next bill is the fireworks bill, House File 1774. You want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1774 to pass and be referred to the Commerce Committee.
Okay, Representative Creasel moves 1774, and do you have an amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair. It's the 0626 amendment that everybody has there.
Okay, Representative Creasel moves the 0626 amendment to get it in the form he would like it. Now, Representative Creasel, on this amendment here, I've looked it over closely and had a series of complaints about the amendment from the nonprofits and other people, and so it's my intention, I guess, is to oppose the amendment, but I don't know if people wanted to testify in favor of it first, but the you probably noticed in your packet, members, that there is another amendment. It's my intention, I guess, is
Daniel Kirk,
right? Mr. Chair, and, which delete all are we talking about?
What's that?
I'm sorry, which delete all were we talking about? Did you say 626?
Yeah, 626, I think was word. Yeah, 626 is the one that the chair is not real familiar with. Sir, when you want to state your name and title and begin on the, you're going to be talking about the 626 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Daniel Peart, and I'm the Retail Operations Director for Phantom Fireworks, one of the nation's leading retailers of 1.4G consumer fireworks, with almost 60 permanent showrooms and over 1,200 temporary locations around the country. Thank you for the opportunity to present my comments on the pending bill to legalize the sale and use of consumer fireworks here in Minnesota. At the outset, please let me emphasize that Phantom Fireworks unequivocally supports the expansion of the types of consumer fireworks to be permitted to be offered for sale and use in Minnesota. Our one and only reservation is that the methodology employed to transport, store, and display these products for sale is done so in the safest manner. The primary focus of this legislation should be to make fireworks sales in Minnesota as safe as possible for the sellers, purchasers, and users of the products, as well as the uninvolved Minnesotans, while also generating additional revenue for the state. This bill currently provides for a reasonable and appropriate increase in the tolerance level of consumer fireworks in the state. For a state such as Minnesota, which currently only permits ground-based or non-aerial types of consumer fireworks to be sold, this is both sensible and easily defensible. To take further steps and permit the sale of the full line of consumer fireworks to be sold in all venues provided for in the National Fire Protection Association Standard 1124, Code for the Manufacture, Transportation, Storage, and Retail Sales of Consumer Fireworks, just because it is listed in print, is an action without basis. NFPA 1124 is the only comprehensive consumer fireworks code recognized by both federal and state enforcement officials. Like any safety standard, it is written to provide protection against all possibilities, as well as safeguard against the worst case possible scenario. It is in no way meant as a means of suggestion. That is not in the scope of the committee responsible for the maintenance of the document, of which I have been an active member for the last 3 years. There are 46 states that permit the sale of some level of consumer fireworks. 39 of them permit firework sales out of temporary venues, such as tents and stands. 15 of those states leave firework sales completely unrestricted in such venues, while the remaining 24 employ some level of rule over such details as the permissible array, location, or even leaving control with the local units of government. It can be portrayed that full-line sales in all venues is the norm in the state in terms of expanded full-line fireworks legislation. However, there is no norm. There are any number of examples of fireworks-friendly states to prove there is no shortage of different ways to address legal and safe consumer fireworks sales and use. Essentially, this is a legislative decision and safety must rule. As Minnesota is considering expansion of consumer fireworks sales and what retail venues are appropriate for such sales, understanding this currently unknown commodity is paramount. The largest consumer firework allowable by law can be packed with up to 500 grams of pyrotechnic composition, showcased in 3-inch diameter aerial shells, can travel 150 to 200 feet straight up in the air, and can explode with a diameter of more than 60 feet and a concussion loud enough to feel in the pit of your chest. Consumer fireworks are proven to be safer today than ever before, but what was just described to you is the intended function of the most popular category of consumer fireworks on the market today, and what any consumer fireworks retail sales facility will be packed full with as we approach the 4th of July. The most basic principle of fire protection, apart from prevention, is containment. The mitigation of a combustible commodity's ability to travel and the fire to propagate. It is categorically impossible to argue that a canvas or membrane structure, such as a tent, has the same safety and containment features as a permanent structure does. What good does quickly exiting through a flapping canvas wall do when the same canvas wall or roof will, without any question at all, be punctured and burned through in a matter of minutes, allowing flaming projectiles to travel considerable distances and potentially to neighboring structures? The danger to adjacent structures, vehicles, and people would be significant, especially considering the most popular and common tent locations are in the parking lot or immediate vicinity of such high extreme traffic areas as big box chain stores, malls, strip plazas, and even gas stations. Patrons of these establishments may not be familiar with the inherent risk that visiting a full-line consumer fireworks retail sales facility presents, or even be aware that they are exposed to such a risk while visiting one of these neighboring non-fireworks-related establishments. Tents will not have such tangible assets as a computerized checkout and information retention systems, video camera surveillance, intrusion and fire alarm systems, but they will also lose some very key intangible assets as well. A tent operator typically operates their tent for a period of 10 days to 3 weeks out of the entire year. As Minnesota considers allowing the full line of consumer fireworks to be sold, is it more appropriate to have someone selling these newly legal, highly flammable products that is a trained, year-round employee fully invested in the fireworks business, rather than a potentially out-of-state part-timer who has never been trained in fireworks safety or possibly never even seen the fireworks they will now be in charge of disseminating to Minnesotans everywhere? The advantage of storage and sale of these products in a permanent sprinkler building is obvious. Amending this legislation to allow temporary venues the ability to sell the full array of consumer fireworks by default would make Minnesota a tent state, much like what's happened in Kentucky in this past year. Last spring, Kentucky passed fireworks legislation of its own and had more than 600 tents some 3 months later for the 4th of July. It is undoubtedly both safe and accurate to say that laws were broken in almost every tent in the state as the fire marshal was left virtually powerless to stop or control this new industry. This presents the immediate potential of financial loss and physical danger to the citizens of Minnesota. The time has come for Minnesota to permit the sale of the full line of consumer fireworks. However, it would be unwise to allow the sale of these products without appropriate reflection and time spent on concurrently adopting a set of standards, regulations, and guidelines that will assure the level of safety to which all Minnesotans are entitled. They are not just entitled to the highest level of safety, but are owed that in the adoption of this legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Before I get to Representatives Smith and Kelly, actually it seems like you've given more ideas to support the bill and the amendment than not. You're fighting an uphill battle in Minnesota because the fireworks is immensely popular in Minnesota, and the dis- the descriptions you describe is exactly what I don't want to see as a conservative: record-keeping, video cameras, a lot of scrutiny and record-keeping. I like the idea of tents. I call that progress, I guess. And so Representative Smith had a comment.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. A question or two of Mr. Peart.
Peart.
You're here representing Phantom Fireworks. According to the web, that's a company based in Youngstown, Ohio, second largest importer of foreign-made goods, fireworks. And I'm looking at the proposed delete all amendment, and there's 11 lines or paragraphs that are quite specific, referencing the facility shall be limited in size to 10,000 square feet of selling area, the aisles be 5 feet wide, one exit door for every 50 people, exit doors shall be metal and equipped with push panic locks, a standalone building, storage areas be separated from where the public can be admitted, facilities shall be located no closer than 50 feet from any facility selling or dispensing gasoline, propane, or other flammable products, and the facility may not be located within 250 feet of another fireworks sales facility. This proposed amendment is quite specific to your one company, to the exclusion of any other company within the state of Minnesota. Isn't that correct?
No, sure. I don't believe that to be correct. All of the requirements that you just listed that are included in this amendment are there for the purposes of safety, and a lot of those requirements are actually are supported by existing code that the fireworks industry and many other industries have adopted in the form of NFPA 1 and NFPA 101, which is fire safety and life safety codes. So those separation distances are oftentimes borrowed from existing codes and then transposed into the fireworks community on its own. So Mr. I don't Chairman. Believe that specifically supports any one business at all.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith,
I'm not going to read for the record. I mean, the hard copy of the proposed amendment is a part of the record, but in reading further, there's a lot of other requirements. For example, and I'm just mentioning one, an operational requirement of $2 million of personal and product liability insurance. It strikes me that this amendment, if it goes on, would be tailored specifically to your company. And frankly, I don't know why I would want to do that in the face of the fact that we've got a capitalist free enterprise system in this country, and anyone who can import fireworks probably ought to, under this bill, have a chance to do so, sell it, make a profit. I'm done.
Okay, members, usually we bring up an amendment like this, an author's amendment, and then we offer it without a lot of discussion and put it into the proper form without a lot of debate. Would it be okay if we took action on this amendment and the other amendment, and then I'd let people testify in favor and opposition that meet your approval? Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Mullery.
I don't have a problem with doing it that way. It seems to be changing, and I'm not sure what's happened to the original bill. I guess there were parts of the original bill I kind of liked, and if we could get the testimony to, if Representative Kriesel would be okay with it, to address both what seemed to be your original thing and then what suddenly seems a lot different. Could we just have that discussed?
Yeah, I think the original bill, and I'll let Representative Kriesel explain this, tailored to open up fireworks and in Minnesota in a broad sense, and then the amendment came from some people that seemed to want to shut it down on tents and more. It looks like it's getting into a business war with one company against the other and tailoring it so one would have an advantage under the guise of safety, in my opinion. And they wanted to restrict and not let tents. And today I had a call from former legislators and people and even somebody who wanted the Boy Scouts to be able to sell fireworks and tents. But this bill, as this amendment would make it with Representative Kriesel's amendment, would not make that possible. So it was my purpose to defeat the original amendment and then offer one of my own, which would put it back in the form where it was open up to tents and more liberal in selling the fireworks. Is that right, Representative Kriesel, pretty much?
Correct, Mr. Chair. The original bill, as far as the 1774 as drafted, my intent was I wanted to have our law similar to Wisconsin. And then, you know, without doing enough research, I see the bill and I realize that Wisconsin's laws are tailored specifically to encourage Minnesotans to drive to Wisconsin, spend money there, purchase fireworks, drive back into Minnesota. They're not meant for Wisconsin residents to purchase. There's significant restrictions on Wisconsin residents purchasing them and being able to use them themselves. So if you see where all of the stores are, they're on the Minnesota border and towns where nobody lives. It's just so people can drive in, buy them, and drive out. So I wanted to correct that and have it so Minnesotans can use them here as well.
Okay, without any further discussion, we're going to vote on the amendment first. Or did you want to discuss the amendment or the bill afterwards?
The amendment.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Pert, I just have maybe a clarifying question, because I know a lot of your testimony was around the safety issue of the tents and things. So if, you know, Walmart's a major supplier here and chain, as opposed to selling those out in the parking lot in a tent, if the criteria was changed a little bit so that they could have that inside in their building structure, you know, Walmart's rather massive, they'll set aside a lawn and garden area or something. So if they meet the building code requirements, would you be okay with them selling fireworks there?
And just to clarify, the only exclusion that I talked about was not limiting sales, or excluding sales from temporary venues. It was limiting the array and the types of consumer fireworks that they would be permitted to sell. But to answer your question specifically, no. If they followed the standard, NFPA 1124, which again is the only recognized standard for consumer fireworks, we as a company would not. We would not have a problem with that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Just a follow-up then. I think some of the people had specific issues with how specific the language was, so that if we actually tweaked that language so that it was inside a safe structure and specific building, then your position would be that you would be okay with that?
In speaking in generalities, you know, I think we can begin to agree on the concept, but we would certainly want to see the final language. But as concept, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Dell. Thank you, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know you want to vote on the amendment, but just a quick clarifying question. I know Representative Kelly touched on this a little bit, but to the testifier, or perhaps maybe to the bill author, you know, right now we have sales of fireworks that are, and I don't know if I know the difference between, you know, fireworks that stay on the ground or ones that shoot up in the air. I think that's what we're talking about here. So would the current fireworks that we sell in the state of Minnesota that are allowed to be sold in tents, would this bill restrict those, or are we just talking about the new ones?
Go ahead, sir. Your answer?
Yes, you're correct. It would not change what is currently being done in the state of Minnesota. This would only be new rules for new fireworks, is the simple way to put it.
Okay, Representative Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a follow-up comment. That seems to be really confusing to me, that we'll have some fireworks still sold in tents, but other different fireworks that wouldn't be allowed to be sold there. So it seems very confusing for the consumers. And, you know, I haven't been here a long time, but one of the things that I have learned since I've been here is that when you agree with the chairman, it's a good idea to point that out. So I like fireworks too, Mr. Chairman.
I think we all miss the old days of the silver salutes, M80s, and cherry bombs. Anyway, if I'd like to move on the amendment here, this the A12, what is it, 0626 is the one the chairman doesn't prefer. Without any more discussion, all in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, the amendment fails. The chair would offer the A12-0666 amendment. And note to reviser, try not to give me an amendment with 666 on the... Bad as 13. The chair would offer the A12-0666 amendment. This seems to get us out of the business conflict here of one against the other and open it up to the sale of fireworks so that more people can do it And I realize it's still controversial, and we'll have testimony in opposition to it. But Chair would offer the A120666 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. The bill in its present form, do we have opposition testimony? Or any more support testimony? I'm sorry.
I think there was some other people that were testifying.
I think there was a citizen here by the name of Craig Block. You come down and state your name and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members.
Try to keep it fairly short. But
let's yeah, I'll keep okay. it short. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Craig Block. I'm just a citizen. I'm just going to talk briefly about fireworks and fire data in Minnesota. Annually, the state fire marshal publishes the Fire in Minnesota report. And I'm just going to pull a couple tidbits from that. I also included it, I think, in your information packet. In 2010, there were 14,561 fires. Of that, 45 of them were caused by fireworks. There were approximately $152 million worth of damage for all total fires. Fireworks were related to 137,000. So 99.7% of all fires were not caused by fireworks. And if you look at the dollar amount, 99.91% as a dollar loss was not caused by fireworks. If you look at the data for population, from the 2010 census, the Minnesota population is approximately 5.3 million. Of that, there were 87 injuries in 2010, which equates to approximately 1 in 61,000 Minnesotans were injured by fireworks. If you compare that to boating, snowmobiling, and hunting, 1 in 85,000 Minnesotans were injured from boating, approximately 1 in 36,000 Minnesotans were injured from snowmobiling, and approximately 1 in 221,000 Minnesotans were injured in hunting. So it's on par with boating and snowmobiling in the state. I also included the related fireworks injuries data from Minnesota that's also in this. From 2002 through 2010, you can see that it had trended up after it was legalized, and then it has been slowly trending downward. And then also I also included the injuries for Indiana, because in 2006, prior to 2006, they were a safe and sane or ground-based fireworks state. And in 2006, they legalized aerial fireworks, such as this bill. And if you note in that, in 2006, there were 251 injuries. And then in 2007, there were 156, 2008, 141, and 2009, 116. So it trended upwards once they legalized it, and then it's been trending downward. And it's interesting, I also want to note that Indiana has an 18% larger population. And I want to end with one quote from the Fire Marshal report.
Go ahead, sir.
That this report allows the Fire Marshal Division to focus on real fire problems and not popular perceptions. And I believe this data shows that fireworks just are not a systemic or real fire problem, rather a perception that they create havoc or epidemic fires.
Okay, thank you, sir. Any questions for the testifier? Appreciate you coming down and taking your time today. All right. Mr. Brace from the State Fire Chief Association, would you like to testify today?
It used to be the, whatever our chief
shop is. And you have Mr. Winkle with you?
Yes.
All right. Either one of you can start to state your name and title and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Brace. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. Prior to that, I was the Minnesota State Fire Marshal from 87 to 2003. Prior to that, I was the Washington State Fire Marshal from 1977 to 86. So I have some background in this discussion this morning. Let me say that I also represent the Minnesota State Fire Department Association, the Fire Marshal Association of Minnesota, and the International Association of Arson Investigators. For a local perspective, on my right is Chief Dan Winkle from Anoka, who will give a local perspective. I'd like to just make a few comments from a national perspective and a state perspective. First of all, I think it's important that second only to Christmas trees, Fireworks are the largest seasonal industry in this country. It is an industry that wraps itself in the flag of many, many wonderful nonprofit organizations. You heard a reference of Boy Scouts, Kiwanis, Elks, Eagles, and so forth. And it's a wonderful fundraiser for a lot of organizations that do a lot of good work. But I think the industry that we need to look at here and what is happening is an expansion of what was known and still known in the trade as Class C fireworks. Very quickly, Class C is determined by the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. Class B is aerial fireworks that we're describing as public displays. Now, make it with no doubt or and with as much clarity as I can add, the Fire Chiefs Association and the other groups I mentioned are for public display of fireworks. We want to make sure that, of course, everyone is who is using them are trained, properly insured, the site is carefully selected, and so forth. But we support public displays as let the professionals use the firework items. Now, nationally, quickly, the latest data I have is 2009, over 18,000 reported fires, 1,300 structural fires, 400 vehicle fires, 16,300 outside and other fires related. No deaths, 30 civilian injuries. One of the problems with fireworks and determining their culpability in fires is many times they no one knows what they were. A, it's destroyed in the fire. B, people a little embarrassed, see, and let me just talk to you briefly about injuries. The injury rate from fireworks in Minnesota, and remember that we adopted fireworks, we were one of those states that had no fireworks at all. We adopted about in 2002. The injury rate went up fourfold, and that was a percentage we've had hospitals reporting at about an 86% rate. So a fourfold increase in injuries, A. B.
Just a second, sir. If you want to move that card out of the way, you can move the camera back in there, and then we can get people back through. That would be fine. You can just move back there, sir. Thank you. Go ahead, sir. Sorry for the interruption.
No, that's all right. If you wanted a little more of a profile about who gets injured, our 10 to 19-year-olds are, we can call them young adults, children, highest percentage followed by 20 to 29, and primarily male that are injured. And you say, oh, but fireworks are a lot of fun, and I think they are a lot of fun, but let's just take a sparkler, which is legal under the current law. If you took the tip of a firework sparkler and measured it for temperature, it's about 1,300 degrees. Now, you cook a roast at 350 in your oven. So you hand this cute little girl that's probably barefoot on a hot summer night a sparkler at 1,300 degrees. So it's no surprise that a sparkler at 1,300 degrees. So it's no surprise that the American Academy of Ophthalmologists are on national record as opposed, because if you ever touch an eye, that eye is gone. Now, it's not my purpose to go through a litany of horror stories, but I do want to emphasize there is an impact on local government with fireworks. Think of the response by fire departments coming out in terms of complaints, law enforcement. Think about pet owners. Many people with large pets sedate them over the 4th of July season because of the trauma connected to that animal. How about the elderly, the people that are homebound and so forth that can't get away from the noise? So, in conclusion, yes, you'll probably find some firefighters. We have over 20,000 in Minnesota that like fireworks. And I think you'll probably find other public safety groups that have expressed appreciation or enjoy of fireworks. But the reality is all of the major fire associations in Minnesota have gone on record as opposing the expansion of fireworks. And when you go aerially, and when you go firecrackers and a string of lady fingers go off, it doesn't take a lot of those that the tempers of the citizenry who are not enjoying that private display clearly will be reflected in editorials and other unhappiness. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning, and also close with the I mentioned the fire groups, the League of Cities, and I think you took care of this, but the League of Cities was also opposed to the amendment with the lack of local control that was important to them.
Okay, before we just want to acknowledge, before I come in, we want to acknowledge the FFA members here. Somebody shout out where you're from.
Watertown.
Watertown. All right. Thank you very much for being here and stick around.
Mr. Chair?
I got a couple of questions first.
Mr. Chair?
Do you want to talk about the FFA group?
Yeah. Just a brief announcement. So that's Watertown Mayor. Watertown is the school I graduated from in 1985. I was an FFH member as well, FFA. So I just wanted to say welcome and good to have you here.
All right. Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Donald, I thought you were going to ask a question. I think, I don't know for sure, but I bet you if you ask a lot of young people about fireworks, they would love to have them and use them. But we want to take a poll here today. But it wasn't your intention, Mr. Brace, to outlaw sparklers, was it?
No, Mr. Chair.
Because they're legal now.
They are legal now. It was to attempt to educate that what most people think is a, you know, very safe and fun thing to have has potential consequences. So, I mean,
I see.
You know, it has been referred by some critics as the recreational use of explosives.
Okay.
And I think there is some truth in that analogy.
The kind of point that I'd like to make is later on today we're going to have a lot of police chiefs railing on the gun bill that's over at the Senate, saying that the citizens can't be trusted with anything. And today we're going to have fire chiefs probably testifying against this bill, saying citizens can't be trusted to their own destiny. And so it just seems kind of unfortunate that we have so many people that believe that Minnesotans can't be entrusted with their own safety, and we have to talk about record keeping and video machine or videos of people purchasing fireworks. And and I know the testimony would be that if we increase the scale and the array of that, we could have more injuries, but there's so many things we could do to stop injuries that we don't do. I mean, we could reduce the speed limit from 70 to 30 miles an hour, undoubtedly save tens of thousands of lives, but you know why we don't do it? Because we like to go down the road and we get to work on time. And similar with fireworks, we could just restrict it and restrict it. We could take all those sparklers away and apple pie and everything else on the holiday. But so, and the truth of the matter is the chief of police that's dealt with this for 4 years in a small farm town, you know what the city council told me? Don't go looking for trouble. You know, if you hear somebody popping them off, you know, on their back porch or lighting them up, and it could very well be a firefighter or a cop that's doing it. We don't look for trouble. If somebody's injured or a neighbor calls a complaint and it's 1 in the morning and you're waking somebody up, fine, but we like to let people have their fun, and I think this is kind of the premise of the bill. We want to open it up not for quarter sticks of dynamite or artillery simulators, but we just like you to get back to the old good old black cat, and when the kid picks up a firecracker and it goes off in his fingers, there's a learning there, and the next time he'll throw it away. I mean, it, I hate to make it that blunt, but... you know,
sorry about that, but that's the way I feel.
Anybody would like to testify? Another one. I'm sorry, Chief.
Chief Winkle.
No, Chief Winkle. Glad to have you here, and I didn't mean to demean any of your testimony or disrespect, but go ahead, Weaver, for your opinion.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Dan Winkle from the city of Andover, and I'm here to talk to you just briefly about Andover's experience with fireworks in the last few years, primarily in the last 6 months, actually. I know that this is general throughout the state, and I appreciate your comments, Mr. Chair. They are right on, and I can't sit here and say that I would be negative, and the fact that not giving people responsibilities, and we're going to take those responsibilities away. I understand your thoughts and your comments, but I can tell you in Andover, as well as other cities, we do have examples fires, and gentleman earlier started talking about costs related to the fireworks in Minnesota, and he started to give you numbers out of the state fire marshal's report. Well, I'm here to tell you a lot of those numbers that aren't in there on a local basis, and this is a device that started a fire in Andover last fall. It's a cone-shaped device that sits on the ground, and it shoots sparks, if you will, in the air 8 to 10 feet, and was placed in the middle of a residential lot, undeveloped residential lot, and pretty much destroyed that lot. So in terms of dollars, we certainly didn't report it. There was some loss there to property. This is another device. It's kind of hard to see. You mentioned an M80, about that size, had a wick on one end, and this was a device that was used to ignite a fire this past Monday, President's Day. In the middle of February, who would think we'd have a wildfire? This started at a city park. We believe juveniles, although we don't know, there was a vehicle involved. Somebody had stopped in the parking lot of the park, got out of their vehicle, and decided to put this down on the ground and start it. Again, this device spins and it shoots sparks off in all the directions as it's spinning. That was a $1,000 event for us, folks. That was not reported in the state fire marshal's report because it wasn't so much damage, but there are costs to get our vehicles out. There are costs to get our firefighters out. Andover being a paid-on-call fire department of 50 members, we have to make sure we have people available, and generally we do, but this was very close to calling mutual aid from our neighbors, which, of course, would escalate the cost. So those are the kinds of costs that you don't necessarily see when you look at some of those other reports. I'm going to close now because you've heard everything, and Mr. Chair, I think your comments are around, but my closing comment to you would be that keep in mind every time that one of these devices is ignited, somebody has to have an ignition source to do that, whether it be a cigarette lighter, a match, or however it is. They're doing a cigarette pipe, well, however you like that wick. Fire, of course, has to have an ignition point, and if we're going to increase the number of ignition points out there by millions, however many we sell every year, the risk will go up. We will have more fires. We will have more damage on a local level, and, of course, we will have more injuries, as was previously stated. And I thank you for allowing me to be here today.
Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Creasel, I'm still not quite understanding the major bill. And is it that you would be expanding what people can have, but that cities can keep it at the present level? Or just can cities restrict it down below the present level of things that are allowed, or just what are exactly are you doing?
Representative Creasel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, the current Chairman Cornish's amendment, as I'm looking through it here, looks to expand what is currently legal. It would be similar to what's legal in Wisconsin. Okay, and I think I saw a part in here saying that on public property it would be a crime to light them off as well, so that would take care of some of the concerns here.
Representative Creasel, if you want, we could have, or Representative Mullery, we could have the our legal staff explain what it does to make it better.
Whoever would explain exactly what the original was and what this one is, what the 666 amendment.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll give it a shot. The original bill sought to give control to the local units of government to issue permits to private citizens for use of fireworks, and it would expand the class of fireworks that they could use beyond what they currently are allowed to purchase at the tents that you'll see in the summer. And that would, the local community could prohibit the use, could regulate the use, and that would give almost complete control local. The county couldn't preempt, say a county had a ordinance, that ordinance would not preempt a city from having a more restrictive ordinance or prohibition. So it would be, it would go down to the lowest level of control.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Diebel,
Representative Mullery.
So the bill would allow the local to allow more than is presently allowed, but the some locals could not allow any more than present? Could they go back from, be more restrictive than what's presently allowed?
Mr. Diebel?
They lost, the way the bill is drafted, they cannot be more restrictive than state law. So the state law is the lowest level, or the highest level.
So they couldn't restrict it more than what the present law.
Yes. But they could, this expansion, they could prohibit.
They could prohibit the expansion. Okay, I think I understand. Then, Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Representative Kriesel, and I guess I would think you'd be one who could understand the problems in some districts, basically inner city districts. I had a student yesterday. He's a college student, I forget what year. He has to be home. His mom requires him home and in the house by 10 o'clock because at around 11 to 2 in the morning, there's so much shooting around him. Two situations occur. It can go either way. With a lot of fireworks, if there's fireworks allowed, what's happened is that people either become accustomed to it or not. So the average citizen can't distinguish between a lot of fireworks and gunshots. And so when it happens more and more, people are running for cover all of the time until they reach a point of saturation and just decide, I can't always, and then they're endangered because they're not taking the action that's necessary when there's shooting going on. So I would hope you would understand that in some cities, this is, the fireworks are really, it's just not a, you know, an uncommon or a little kind of a tiny annoyance. It actually endangers lives eventually. So I just hope you'll take that very seriously into account. And I would think you were on the front lines and you would know that if there was so much shooting that you got to the point where you didn't react, or there was so much noise that sounded like you better go for cover, that you were no longer reacting to it, it'd be very deadly. And so I just hope you'll really consider that problem.
Okay, is there anybody else to testify in opposition? Seeing none, any questions from the committee? This bill will be moving to the judiciary, Congress. And Representative Kriesel, would you like to renew your motion or make any closing statement?
I would like to renew my motion, Mr. Chair, for House File 1774 to pass and be referred to the Commerce Committee. And just in closing, I respect their concerns. I respect your concern, Representative Mullery. The thing we have to remember, I think everybody in this room has heard people in their neighborhood right near them firing these, what's currently illegal, off. I mean, my neighborhood sounds like Fallujah. I mean, it sounds constant fireworks during the 4th of July season. They purchased these from the Dakotas and Wisconsin. This is revenue that we're losing. These are jobs we're losing. So there's multiple different ways to look at it. Local governments, this would increase the burden, one could think, but I think that the local governments already deal with it or choose not to deal with it, like Representative Cornish said. So that's pretty much what I have to say. I hope I can get your support on this bill.
Okay, seeing no other questions, Representative Kreisel restated his motion to pass House File 1774 as amended and recommended to pass and move to Commerce. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Representative Spudinski. Okay, Representative Spudinski, second. Representative Spudinski, I would move your bill for you. House File 2333 be recommended to pass and move to
Civil Law Committee.
And the bill's in front of us. Do you have any amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have an A1 amendment.
Okay.
That's the only one, Mr. Chair.
I don't have an amendment here. A1.
Mr. Chair, would I be? Should we do? No. Okay.
All right. What was the amendment about? Well,
yeah,
why don't you present your bill and then we'll talk about the amendment.
Well,
I'd have
good.
To get
we'll
the okay from the DFL people. If it's very extensive, we might have to catch up to it in the next
All
committee.
Right. Mr. Chair, members, this is a fairly non-controversial bill. This bill helps small businesses streamlining the process to collect money on motor fuels and drive-offs. It prescribes that the trade associations acting on behalf of member organizations, retailers, can serve notice and collect payments within current collection statutes. This bill will help law enforcement personnel by permitting the fact finder of the drive-off case to infer that the driver of the vehicle has dispensed motor fuel intentionally and deprived the retailer of payment. This inference is in good law and already contained in statute. So essentially, committee, this bill is being brought forward by the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association for their membership, the small gasoline retailers across the state. This situation with fuel prices becoming what they are becoming, there's an increased amount of fuel drive-offs. And if you're a small realtor, maybe or a retailer, it's an increasing burden to do in end of the day collections. And so this will allow the trade association. The main part of the amendment is to focus it in, not necessarily just to trade organizations, but allow them to become 501c3 status as far as the collection process. We have Bob Krogman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association, also to speak on behalf of this bill.
It's okay at the committee. I'd like to have Mr. Krogman's testimony before questions, if that's okay. Mr. Krogman, if you go ahead and explain in layman's terms what we are doing now and what the problem is and how this will fix it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. They've got about 700 members all around the state. They deliver fuel to farms, construction companies, they deliver heating oil, and they own and operate about 2,000 of the state's 3,500 convenience stores. All of them are family-owned businesses or locally-owned cooperatives. What we're looking at here is allowing the trade association, us and there are other trade associations, to serve a notice that's allowed by statute 60415 to folks who drive off without paying. The reason we're looking at doing that or requesting to do that is that that statute has a section in it that says notice of dispute. And if they send out a notice of payment and the person that gets the payment writes back and says, I didn't do it, have to stop all collection procedures. And if you're going to go any further, you have to go to conciliation court. We're not suggesting changing that statute. We think that's a good part of that. We're just suggesting that inhibit some of the smaller members from sending out the notice of payment and following through on that. We've had several tells if you could do this, we could make it a lot easier. That's simply what we're looking at, is performing a member service for those drive-offs. One other change in here is that for us to do that, we have to have the license number, license plate number, they either write down or get off of a video recording at the station, and they have to have a description of the vehicle, and the clerk or whoever saw it has to say, put out what happened. We use that in the mailing to send it out and say, you drove off, could you please send us the money? The second part of this bill talks about defines the crime, if you want, of driving off. It already is somewhat in statute, but it had to be clarified because it's somewhat unique in that if, for example, somebody steals an expensive bottle of whiskey and sticks it under his coat and walks out of the liquor store and gets caught, they have the bottle of whiskey there and says, you stole this. With gasoline, and you put it into the tank, we can't get it out, and even if we could, we couldn't fingerprint it to that station. So there's no physical property that we can say was stolen. We can't say you took this. All we have is an electronic record, and we have an electronic record of every sale at the POS system and a license plate number. They will send that license plate to us. We have a contract with Motor Vehicle Services where they will send us the information, license plate, this car is owned by this. They will not send it to every service station out there. They don't want that rapidly disseminated, and we also agree with that. Driving off, and if you have this license plate, and you report it to the police have a problem with it because it's not really enough information for them to criminally prosecute. We've been told by several police departments that can't do anything with intent. We don't know. All the guy has to say is, I wasn't driving the car. So there's nothing we could do about this. We looked at this as a permissive intent. That comes from a couple of other statutes. 609, 672, permissive inference, firearms and automobiles. 152.028, permissive inference of knowing possession. I think the best example I can give of this is, let's say there's a camper drives off from a truck stop with 100 gallons of diesel fuel. They got the license plate, they got a good description of the camper, they call it in, report it to the police, that camper's picked up driving down 94. The officer could conclude that the driver took off without intention of paying because that goes with the facts. A license plate number, a good description of the camper, and a statement from the clerk. So that permissive inference, infer that the driver acted intentionally because everything's there and he didn't pay. The rebuttal is if he pays it, or if the license plate reported stolen or the vehicle is reported stolen. You could also pay within 30 days. That, we think, will help the police to establish this better as a crime. Mr. Chairman, I'd answer any questions.
Okay, we have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krogman, I can't remember the last time I was able to purchase some gas without paying first. Is this a problem that's been that's diminishing these days, or is it are people still purchasing gasoline without paying first
to
that extent?
Oh, sorry. Mr. Corcoran?
Chairman, Representative Johnson, drive-offs increase somewhat with the price. It's not like it's epidemic. Talking to some of our retailers, some of the bigger ones keep pretty good records. They tell me it's about 0.5%. In other words, if you sell 100,000 gallons a month at a station, the average fill is 12 gallons. That number comes from the MasterCard Pulse report surveying millions of dollars of credit card receipts. That 12 gallons per average, you know, 7,000, 8,000 customers. Well, those stations will have between 5 and 10 drive-offs in a month. But those 5 to 10 drive-offs, that 60 gallons at 3.5 is substantial. And most of them, now most is maybe not the right word, a lot of them are truly mistakes. Folks drove off. This allows to send a letter, say, hey, you forgot to pay. And a good portion do send the money in for those who operate the system.
Okay. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm sympathetic to the petroleum dealers who have to deal with this problem. I'm also sympathetic to the public because they have to purchase the price of fuel, and I've just noting that in Alaska today, unleaded is at $6.34 a gallon. In Orlando, it's $5.79 a gallon. So, I mean, it's a big problem for both the consumer and for the retailer. As I mentioned, I think when we talked earlier, Mr. Krogman, that it'd be nice to simplify this. In my opinion, it's an easy solution, not necessarily dealing with this legislation, but public relations. I think, to me, it'd be cheaper to hire a minimum wage person to be out on the drive to keep an eye on the cars and also greet the customers than it would be to go through all of these hoops and all of the expense that there is. One drive-off would probably pay that. I mean, I know it's not the answer, but to me, it's a simple solution because in my community, the consumer is very suspicious of the industry because the second the price goes up one place, it goes up every place. And so there doesn't appear to be any competition or efforts to be, you know, it seems like there's a network. As soon as they hear a price increase somewhere, then instantly the neighborhood goes up. And that's the change. So I'm just saying, from a public relations standpoint, I'd like to see some things maybe from the dealer's side. But I understand the problem. We've lost at least one business who couldn't afford to write the check when the tanker truck came to deliver the fuel. And they now put on trailer hitches and, you know, they do light maintenance, but they can't sell fuel anymore. So I understand the problem. I'm just kind of trying to see it from both sides. And from the consumer side, they just see it's going to be a bigger problem just to be able to afford to pay the bill.
I'd rather just leave that as a comment than with 2 minutes, too, and I'm hungry. But Representative Hill, Hilty. I'm sorry, I almost said Hillary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Initially, there was reference to an amendment, which we don't have here. I know the bill is going to civil law, which I serve, but I was wondering, is there an amendment forthcoming? And if so, what was the nature of the amendment?
That's a good question, Representative Hilty. What was the amendment? What content? What did it do so we don't let something out of here without?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, the amendment was simply something that Senator Latz requested. He's an author in the Senate. And he wanted the definition of trade association to be as tight as possible. So the amendment would have said, a trade association recognized by the Internal Revenue Service as a 501c6 exempt organization. It would say that this is a bona fide trade association. That was simply the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Representative Hilty. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, would the chair think about requiring, if this is going to civil law, to have them send it back so we could see the amendment, the bill as amended? Would you consider asking civil law, once it goes out of here, if it does, that civil law return it to us as amended so we could see it in writing? I trust the testifier to be truthful, but I would also like to read it myself.
Representative, that's a big step to take when we already know what the amendment. How about if it changes, that amendment changes from what it is now?
send it back.
So, yes. Mr. Chairman, you're going to let the civil law committee decide if it changes?
Well, it's the definition of a trade association, but so. Otherwise, we have to, yeah, Representative Rudinsky.
Mr. Chair, could we offer that amendment as an oral amendment?
With the DFL's approval, because there's going to be amendments that they come up with that they'll want to get into. So. It's up to you folks. You want to add it on the civil law or here?
Well, Mr. Chair, I hate to interrupt, but I've just been handed purports to be an amendment. I showed it to the author. He's nodding. It's like 8-9 words. Why don't we just do it orally?
It's up to you guys. All right. I just want to be fair here. Could we, why don't you read it again and then give it to legal staff so they don't have to just scribble it down? In the future, we'll try to get the amendments in the 24 hours.
I'll read it.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, so if we can open up the bill, we can go to page 2, line 18. The amendment would insert before May, trade association services under that title, trade association may, and then it's in front of a may, recognized, in quote, recognized by the Internal Revenue Service as a 501c6 exempt organization on behalf of a member retailer.
Okay, and if you want to hand that to the legal so they can get every word right. Mr. Diebel, is that the way it was described there? Understand that and fit the bill?
Hey, Mr. Chair, it's drafted to the Senate file, and I guess I'm assuming that it's the same page and line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why don't we do that in civil law? I want to just add something here as we're kabobbling back and forth. Okay. The bill, here we are. Post file 2333, civil law. You've recommended to pass and move to civil law. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, thank you. Next meeting Tuesday. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.